is Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio and the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to the show, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence coming to you from New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Larisha Hawkins and Warren Craighead. But first, Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, I am there. Don't worry, I'm here. I'm here. I am so happy to be with you today. It's almost like we haven't talked all week. And this is my time to really enjoy your voice, because I don't get to hear it enough from Monday to Friday.
For and all of our listeners, we talk constantly.
No.
Should we keep it like under the veil?
You never return my calls.
Go on.
Terrible.
Go on.
I will, because I wanted to thank you on the air for yet another A-list panel of guests. You've done it again. You've outdone yourself. It's an amazing show, and thank you for that.
Yes. Well, I couldn't do it without you or with our great guests. We're really fortunate to have them here. You know,
indeed. And you know, you always thank the Beckham team at Keller Williams, but I know I have yet to do that. And it is amazing that they sponsor us. So I'm all full of gratitude this morning. Apparently,
so everyone go buy.
But I mean that it's great.
Go buy a house. Go sell a house. The Beckham team. So I wanted to mention something funny that happened this week. Wednesday, the White House launched a new office to assist victims of crimes committed by criminal aliens. And what happened? Some people called in with reports of UFOs. Did you hear that?
No, I didn't. But isn't someone always, not to downplay that, but doesn't always someone see something in the sky, a flash?
Yeah, I know. I mean, but the point is, you know, it was that criminal aliens, you know, extraterrestrials.
Well, you know.
Can you hear me? Sometimes,
every
Nancy,
border is suspect, you know. Yeah. Even the one in the atmosphere. Apparently, everyone's pouring in from every orifice of the solar system, you know. So.
Right.
let's just have another ice intergalactic. I'm not sci-fi enough, but some sort of intergalactic patrol, excuse
right.
me.
Right.
That, of course, we'll need a ban of some sort shortly from a judge in Hawaii.
Right.
Can I connect any more of the politics going on?
I'm not sure. Could you weave in a golf course, perhaps?
Oh, that's yeah. That's how the border, the wall, the intergalactic wall is so porous because Trump keeps knocking down the virtual bricks with yet another lousy whatever those are called swing.
He mocked Obama for years about playing golf, and he has spent 7 of 14 weekends at Mar-a-Lago playing golf.
I know.
No surprise.
I know. It's totally different rules for that guy. It's amazing. And, that, you know, he has no sense of of the outrage he has for others. It just doesn't stick. It just doesn't. There's no such thing as self-reflection, which is too bad because, you know, if he could see himself in the mirror, quite frightening. He is that.
I was just going to say that an event I wanted to mention just to protest, to continue protesting, which I'm loving that we're doing as a country. Today is the People's Climate March in D.C., and we also have an event here in Charlottesville, and it focuses not only on climate justice but social and economic justice. And there are a lot of sister marches around the country. And the one here is at the, it's also going to be sponsored or hosted, so to speak, by Indivisible, Charlottesville, at 1 o'clock at the Freedom of Speech Wall on the downtown mall. There's going to be music, local speakers sharing their stories. Indivisible does a great job with getting people to tell their stories, and they're always really moving. I'm always glad I go. And also talking about solutions to the climate crisis. And then at 2, they're going to march down the mall, ending with a rally back at the wall.
That sounds incredible. You know, it's like with this administration came, save your Saturdays. There's always
right.
something meaningful
right.
that you need, you know, we need to show up for to push. I mean, don't you think that is the... As much, you know, as the Democrats can do, you know, that it's really the people that are stopping mm-hmm. the Republicans from
Absolutely. You know, we've beaten back. Amazing. We've beaten back the Muslim ban, the Trump care, Bill O'Reilly. So let's just keep doing it. Showing, right. You know, we need to show leaders that will resist attacks on our people and our communities and our planet.
Yeah. Well said. It's 100 days of resistance along with 100 days of Trump. You know,
So speaking of mocking Trump, we have an amazing show today. I wanted to introduce our first guest. He is Warren Craighead. Warren is an artist. He has exhibited his work both in the U.S. and internationally and has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize. He received an MFA in 96 from the University of Texas at Austin and a BFA from VCU in Richmond. Recently, Warren has been drawing daily grotesque portraits of Donald Trump. And Retrofit Comics is publishing the first 6 months of that project in July, and they called his work some of the best political cartooning that's happening right now, and he is still drawing. You can see those drawings as we speak if you're at home, and hope not in your car, at trumptrump.biz. Welcome, Warren.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Thank you, Warren, so much for being here. I'm glad you could finally. I've been trying to get you here for a while. I'm glad you're here.
I'm really glad to be here, too. Thanks
Good.
For having me.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so what started this for you, and when did you start doing these? I would say they're hideous drawings, but so fun to look at.
I would say accurate, but I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ellen.
Well, you just mentioned holding up a mirror for him to see himself, so really that's what I'm doing, right? I'm trying to draw him the way that he is. I mean, it's not that hard, because he's kind of a horrible-looking person to start with. That's kind of mean of me, but I'm not happy with what he's doing to all of us. I started last summer. I could back up. I've done some other projects in the past where I draw grotesque portraits of people. A few years ago, I started a project called Lady Haters, where I draw grotesque portraits of misogynist public figures. And then an offshoot of that is a project called USA Haters, where I draw un-American public figures. And my idea of un-American is very different from that of people on the right, I think. My un-American is people who are racist, who are homophobic, transphobic, who hate poor people. I've done these projects before, but last summer, of course, as we all, the mounting horror of, oh my gosh, he's won the Republican nomination.
Yeah.
And it's really real. That night when he was accepting the nomination, I thought, I need to draw this guy, and I'll draw him every day. I'll do these pictures of him every day and publish them online, thinking I would be done in November. And then November came, and I wasn't done. And I remember that day, some of my friends were on Twitter giving me a hard time, like, you said you'd keep drawing until the nightmare ends. And I said, I will keep drawing until the nightmare ends. So I've continued to draw him and his minions, and his handlers and the people in charge of him since then. And the drawings have gotten more and more complex, more and more complicated, as more things have happened, as he's actually doing things instead of just saying things. And I've really tried to capture both the sort of frighteningness of what his administration is trying to do, and also just try to do it in a way that is visually entertaining and funny.
Sorry, is it a burden for you at all? How is it when you're doing these drawings?
No, I had someone I work with who said, I'm worried about your mental state because I've got to stare at I've got to pay attention to him. But actually, it's great because I can do something about it when he does something like like the Muslim ban, or he says something horrible, or they try to push this horrible revision of Obamacare. I can actually draw about it and draw, you know, Paul Ryan and Trump on top of a pile of dead bodies, because that's what would happen. I can do some really grotesque things to him and get that anger out. It also helps me to really pay attention to what's going on, because I remember when Bush was selected over Al Gore in 2000, I just checked out for a few months from politics because I was so upset. And this time it's like, no, I'm staying on it, and I'm able to stay with it, even though, I mean, it's just such a barrage of insanity every day.
Mm-hmm. And for people who haven't seen them, I hope you will go look. They are also, they help the viewer, I find, also in the same way that you described. You just really feel vindicated. You're like, yes. You know?
Yeah, so There was an the Comics Journal, which is a magazine, did an interview with me before the election about this project, and they asked me, you know, why are you doing this? And I thought, well, on the one hand, like I said, it's kind of cathartic for me. And they asked, or someone asked me, you know, are you just preaching to the choir? And I said, well, that's one thing I'm doing, but it's good to preach to the choir. That's why the right. preachers preach to the choir. They're the people who are going to listen to you and go out and make a difference in the world. And so, not that I'm inspiring huge differences in the world, but it is important for us to buck ourselves up and say, yeah, this is bad. We shouldn't accept this. This is not normal. The normalization of all of the things Trump is doing, from the policy things to the way he's kind of destroying some of our political norms, it's important to not let that go. Kind of like Gorsuch, it's like he should always have an asterisk next to his name on all of his decisions. We should know that Merrick Garland never got his hearing. So that's one thing to do. I think a level up from that is, during the election, one of my ideas was, there were a lot of people that I think have really soft support for Trump. A lot of my friends or people who I knew who are on Facebook, people I grew up with, who supported Trump, but they held their noses and did it. And I wanted to keep their feet to the fire. Like, this is who you're voting for. You're voting for the guy who boasted about sexually assaulting women. You voted for the guy who was completely racist about President Obama's birth, and make it uncomfortable for them to continue to do that. And I think that's one thing where a lot of people can just kind of check out, and I want to do my best to make them not be able to check out, which means I try to draw things as well as I can, so they're very attractive to look at, even though they're horrible things.
I noticed on your Tumblr page, where I believe these started, right? The drawings, the daily drawings?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. That you also include a link of the audio of, related to your drawing. I just wondered which came first, or how that connection between the two.
Yeah, so I do a drawing, and then I add either a quote from Trump, that's how I started, or I write about what I'm drawing about, and then I link to it. And a friend of mine who's a former journalist gave me that advice years ago with Lady Haters, because he said, you can just write this quote, but people might not think that, they might think you're just making it up. But if you put a link to where it came from, what the source is, it's gonna give it more gravity and make it, you know, people can go back and look and say, yeah, he really did say that. He's quoted in the Times or on Fox News, or, well, I don't know if I trust that very much, but you know what I'm saying. And so in the book, so we're publishing a book of the first 6 months of these, from the nomination to the inauguration. In the book, we're going to have all of those notes, and in the back have a kind of bibliography of all the links, so people can go check those out. So I think it's important to have, you know, I'm doing something very subjective, but I should at least, you know, cross my T's and dot my I's on that kind of thing.
Yeah, surely. And I was, you know, looking at all of that and just wondering, at what point did you realize in that 6 months or so that this should be a book, or I'd like this to be a book, or did someone approach you and say, you know, to do that?
So I had an idea to have these published. I've published a lot of books, both zines and comics, and I do a lot of things in the kind of alternative comics world. And the work I've done in that over the last 20 years is mostly known for this less political things, let's say, like very poetry comics, that this kind of thing. But I had ideas to do this, but the publisher at Retrofit Comics, Box Brown, who's a great artist in his own right, I would tell people to go out and look for his New York Times best-selling graphic novel. It's a biography of Andre the Giant, and it is fantastic. Anyway, he approached me to say, let's publish this. This needs to get a wider audience. And so him, along with the owner of Big Planet Comics, they worked together to publish. They put me in their 2017 season, which they're kickstarting right now. A lot of small publishers, if you think of them like chapbook poetry publishers or small record labels, that's what these small comics publishers are like. A lot of them use Kickstarter to help get the capital to do the initial print run. So they're doing that now, and I'm part of a whole season with Zach Hazervopin, Laura Kennens, Tara Booth, Yuichi Yokohama, Will Carnini, and me are all these books that are coming out. And it's a great way to pre-order the book. You can also, if you order the book and give a little more, I will draw you a Trump and send it to you, an original one. I will also, the premium one for me is, I will draw you with Trump doing anything you want. You could be kissing him. You could be pooping on him. Whatever you want, I will draw it within I suppose there's a certain limit I won't go past, but we'll negotiate that. But I like this idea of this Kickstarter for these books too, because it both allows them. I mean, they're giving us all artist advances. It allows them to take care of the artist, but it also allows books that wouldn't normally be able to be published to get published. And I think a book like this, it's going to be 200 pages. It's going to be hardbound or hardcover. It's expensive to print, and so this sort of grassroots funding of it is going to really help. And hopefully, I mean, I plan on doing volumes of this. I mean, hopefully there'll only be one more volume because he'll get impeached pretty soon, so we won't have to do much more.
That's a drawing I'm looking forward to seeing, and I want to just plug the site. It's bit.ly/retrofit, so it's bit.ly/retrofit.
Retrofit 2017.
2017.
Yeah, or you can search Kickstarter Retrofit or go to Retrofit Comics or my website. The link is everywhere.
Yeah, so. And it's a great video. It's not your typical, I don't know, it's not boring. It's real, because it's done by artists. So it's fantastic.
And, I mean, the other artists aren't, the work that they have being published isn't political, but they're some of my favorite artists. And Retrofit does a great job. They publish some great artists, Leela Corman, Simon Morton. They're a great publisher of small comics. And some of the people in this season with me, I'm just so stoked to be a part of it. I can't. It's the kind of thing where you can't believe that you're allowed to be with these people.
Warren, so. You're amazing. I wanted to ask you maybe a personal question. I love the Lady Haters series that you mentioned also, which was about lady haters in the public eye. You know, you did drawings of people like the Roman Catholic Archbishop who talked about, he specifically said you could avoid hitting women by, if they just did what they were supposed to do, things like that. And you're bringing those things to light. And also people that we know, like Trump and Bill O'Reilly. Where did your compassion for women come from?
Well, I mean, I at a base level, I'd say I'm a human being.
Right.
And, you know.
Sorry to ask that. I just feel like you're a little more sensitive.
I mean, I'm married and I have two daughters, but I don't want to say as a father of two daughters, blah, blah, blah. Because really... You know, I mean,
well, you'd have to run for Congress then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, I was raised in a sort of, I would say, a feminist household where it wasn't, you know, my mom wasn't, or my parents weren't activists and running around doing all these things, but it was sort of a low key feminism in that it was just assumed, you know, men and women are equal and should be treated equally. It was not, you know, they weren't out like, you know, protesting and burning things down, but they definitely had an attitude where I grew up just thinking, yeah, of course these people are, you know, we're all the same. And it was the same with people of different races, people of different religions, people from different parts of the world. It was just sort of assumed this is what it was. For lady haters, what set me off here in Virginia, there was, if you remember back then, they were trying to pass a transvaginal ultrasound for women who wanted to have abortions, which means that all women would be violated, but especially women who were victims of rape or sexual assault would be violated again in order to have an abortion. And I was really mad because, not just because of that, but because a lot of these state legislators get to hide. People don't know who, I bet, you know, your audience, well, you guys are probably pretty educated, but there's a lot of people around who have no idea who their state legislators are, and they get away with all kinds of things. And so my thought was, well, I'm going to draw these people and show who they are. Here's the people pushing this horrible bill. Here's the people who are trying to take away all of our rights. Because, I mean, women's rights are my rights, too. You know, they're all of our rights. So that's where it started, and then it kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah. Great point. Yeah. Thank you. We're going to go to a break right now, and we'll come back. We'll finish talking with Warren and then Dr. Larisha Hawkins. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Apropos of Something here on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville and Resistance Radio. We are talking today with artist Warren Craighead. In a little bit, we're going to talk to Dr. Larisha Hawkins. So, Warren, I wanted to ask you, Nancy,
yes,
are you there?
I've done this before. Just as many questions as Ellen.
Wait, we have questions, but I feel like I was supposed to have done a news bit with you.
Well,
is that true?
No, it's not. Nothing's true. It's fake news. No,
okay. No, I mean, we could do that now. I mean, I really want to talk to Warren.
Yeah, I think.
Okay, so let me go on. Interrupting myself. Sorry about that. So, Warren, what other political work have you done? I think you've done quite a bit more.
Yeah, so I like I said earlier, most of the work I've done hasn't been political in the past. I do a lot of poetry, comics. I don't know how else to describe it, but a lot of work that's about just experiences in the world. So it's funny to me that this first big book of mine that's coming out is basically political cartooning, because I never thought of myself as that political or as a cartoonist. But a few years ago, when the Arab Spring was happening, I was watching it live in Tahrir Square in Cairo, and was very, very moved by what was happening. And I know that that revolution had kind of turned sour and not good, but at the time, there were such high hopes, and so I made a book out of that. It's on my website. You can see on craighead.com about that, just how, just a message to them, just how inspired I was. And so I started drawing more and more from the news and from things. So I did a whole piece on Ferguson. There were like a couple hundred photos from the crime scene where the shooting was, and I drew all of those pictures. When the first chemical attack was in Syria a few years ago, I drew from those photos and made a book out of that, with the proceeds going to a charity that helps Syrian children. I would say, if you go to my website and look at that, you should brace yourselves, because it's a pictures of dead children and things like that, which is pretty horrible for me to look at. But I made myself do it, because part of being an artist, I think, is witnessing and not letting the stuff just disappear and go away. And then, you know, Lady Haters, USA Haters, I started those around that time. A few years ago, when Ken Cuccinelli was running for governor, of course, I was opposed to him. And so I drew him every day for a week, just 1 week, mostly to try to get to motivate people to come out, because I think on these off-year elections that Virginia has for governor, it's sometimes hard to get people to come out and vote. And luckily, you know, we didn't have him as governor. So I've done these things sort of politically over the years that have reflected my sort of my feelings about politics and social justice. But this is really knocked it wide open. I mean, part of it is doing these elaborate drawings every day. I mean, I was drawing them last night, drawing Trump last night. I'll be drawing him later today, and I'll be drawing him tomorrow. So, it's definitely been a journey, of going, I still do the other work that I do as well. But it's been great to have this sort of outlet and be able to try to strike a blow, however tiny, for justice.
I was wondering about the drawings. In this case, I hear that you do sequential drawings on many occasions, actually. But for these, for the Trump ones, do you set any restrictions for yourself, like a certain amount of time, a size of paper, you know, so many a day? Or what's your process, if there is one?
Well, when I started, I drew them all on index cards. I drew them pretty quickly, and I just scanned them basically with my phone. But as I got more elaborate and as more things were happening, I started drawing them now. I mean, I'll give you some technical things. I draw them on vellum, Bristol, 6x9. I buy pads of 9x12 and cut them in half. It's what I draw pretty much everything on. And then I scan them in my computer in Photoshop, you know, crop them and make them look good, and then publish them. I draw them all with pencil, which is what I draw everything with. I mean, I think with a project like this, you have to kind of standardize things so that you're not reinventing the wheel every day. But I do, there's times when I pay attention to what's going on in the news and specifically draw specific things for a specific thing that's happening. There's other times I'm like, in the back of my mind, I know, oh, I'm going to draw Sebastian Gorka at some point. I've got in the back of my mind what I'm going to do. And when I have a day that I don't have a specific thing to draw, I'll draw that. Lately, the last couple of weeks, I've been just drawing these big grotesque portraits of his face over and over again. And I think I can already tell, you know, in the couple hundred drawings I've done so far, that it's going to go in waves and sort of things. As I get tired of drawing one thing, it'll change over to others. In fact, starting today, I'll be publishing one or putting ones up where it's not just his face, it's going to be his whole body, but a really twisted version of it. As things change, when you do something over and over, it naturally changes over time.
Have you ever tweeted to Trump?
Oh, I tweet at him every time. And I would love it if he got mad. I every time I tag him, every time I can. Sometimes the text that goes with the drawing is a tweet of his, and it fills up the 140 characters. But I also sometimes go on the hashtag MAGA. I look at that and I troll some people there, and I've been told I'm mentally ill. And
that
whatever.
Is that. I'm not familiar with
well,
that.
Well, MAGA is, you know, Make America Great Again. And a lot of his supporters. But what's funny is sometimes his supporters will just reflexively retweet or like my drawings. And I'm like, you didn't even really look at this, did you?
Wow.
Because I mean, that's not the nicest thing that I do, but it's on Twitter. I mean, it's not like it's I'm hurting anybody, but I think I would love it if Trump got mad. And I have some plans for the book. I mean, I live a couple hours away from D.C. There's ways to go on White House tours. You know, leave a book with the, you know, give it to them to give to him. We'll see. But the Trump winery is just down the street from us, so we'll see.
Right. I think we should do a protest there. We've been talking about that.
Yeah,
I would love to see, I don't know, actually, Warren, I don't know if you've drawn this, but I would love to see a slice of tremendous or beautiful or whatever, however you describe that chocolate cake from you. Did I miss that? Have you drawn any?
I haven't. No, you mean the one that he had when he was both talking to the leader of China and bombing Syria at the same time?
Yeah, launching missiles or, yes, exactly.
Or maybe that was the big bomb in Afghanistan. I can't. They're all mixing all the death is mixing together in my mind.
Well, he also didn't know who he was bombing at one point. And he told the reporter he was bombing the wrong thing. Hey, Nance, can you hear me? Oh, Nance?
Yeah?
Oh, are you there? Okay. Sometimes Nancy and I, there's an overlap because of the technical, amazing technical things that we have going on between New York and Charlottesville. So, sorry.
It's a hairpin. It's a bobby pin.
We're being held together by safety pins. Sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm totally done. That's what you're trying to tell me.
No, I'm done. I'm done.
All right. Warren, I was just curious, if you go back and forth in looking at your drawings, or is that something, obviously, that you don't do, that you just keep moving forward and let them accumulate?
I go back and look sometimes, but mostly I'm just moving forward. I mean, I do now. I've developed a kind of lexicon of things. So if you see in a drawing a piece of pizza walking around, that's a reference to the fake news of the Pizzagate thing, where they had some crazy idea about that pizza place in D.C., or there's always a hand coming in from the side giving a sort of Nazi salute. That's, to me, is all of his supporters who are horrible people. Not all of them are that way, but there's a lot that are. And then there's other various little things that come in. I mean, to me, when I draw Jeff Sessions, he's always attended by a bunch of little triangle-headed Klans people, or the money people, the people who are trying to loot and take all of our money. They're always attended by a bunch of spiders who are grabbing. So, you know, again, when you do something like this, you end up making all these little stories in your mind, and it just sort of helps to add to the whole atmosphere of it. So
is and completely left field, I guess, but sort of anyway, is drawing something you've done all your life?
Yeah. Someone was described to me, he said, Warren, you're ABCD, always be drawing crazy. Or always be crazy drawing. I'm sorry. So I was literally just drawing now Ellen here in the studio, and I put it up on my Instagram feed, which fed to the other social media. So I've drawn since I was a kid. My dad, my mom, my grandmothers were all artists. My brother's a video artist. My wife's family is all artists. My kids are out there outside the studio, probably drawing right now. So I draw all the time. I have a sketchbook in my pocket at all times, and I find it's a great way to remember things, to experience the world, to draw things, to get my anger out, to understand the world.
I can vouch for that. We've worked together before and we're friends, and I would find little drawings at my desk, or even I think I found one in the grocery store one time. You leave these little tiny post-it notes.
Yeah, I'll draw on post-it notes and leave them around town. So the gas station, people's houses.
Goodness.
Yeah. So
it's pretty great.
You know, you mentioned your kids, and I was wondering about those comics. I noticed you draw comics of your kids. What are those like, and how did that happen?
Yeah, so I do a series called Foves, which is about, basically, I used to write down crazy things my kids did or said, and I said, well, I should draw this. And I mean, honestly, a part of it is to hold on to them as kids, to remember this stuff. I'm obsessed with remembering and holding on to things. And of course, as kids grow, you're like, it's always bittersweet. I'm happy with who they're becoming, the young women they're becoming, but I'm also sad they're not the little crazy kids that they were. So anyway, so I I draw this stuff. This is probably the most traditional comics I've ever done, and I try to draw the crazy things they do, like when they, you know, shoot edamame at each other, or they decide that they're going to wear a sandwich as a hat or something like that. I mean, you know, it's what kids do. So that's a weekly strip that I put on Comics Workbook. Oh. Yeah, so that comes out every week.
Wow. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Warren.
Yeah. Yes.
Want to leave time for our next guest. Warren, thank you so much. We love talking to you. Please come back.
I will come back when the book comes out, and I really appreciate it. Everyone go check out the Kickstarter at Retrofit and support the book. I'd love for everyone to have one.
Yes, yeah, so you can see the drawings at trumptrump.biz.
Thanks.
Thank you, Warren.
Yep.
So, Nancy.
Yeah, do you want to?
We have like a minute, you know. Do you want to?
Okay. Yes, yeah, so I'm changing the segment as alluded to earlier in our exchange of emails when we weren't talking to each other. Let's call it the news of note.
Okay.
Okay.
I have one.
So no more downer in the middle of the show.
Right. No more of that. We have enough downers, and we're not that funny, really. So.
But nonetheless, I must confess that what I'm about to say is not exactly an upper.
Okay.
So my news of note is, very quickly, Confederate Memorial Day, apparently, has come and gone last week, and I had really no idea there was such a thing. That's on me. But what I don't understand about it is how it continues to be promoted as anywhere close to being patriotic or a part of America's history, when the whole notion, I'm sure you know, is just that they wanted to break up the Union. So how does the South, or the people like that, rather, in the South, continue to get the mantle of the real Americans when, you know, they're still looking fondly on that time when they almost broke away?
I right.
don't get it.
You have a feeling,
anyway,
Dr. Hawkins, maybe she'll field that question, because I'm just going to give you a shrug on that one. I see a lot of those flags here, being in the South of the Mason-Dixon line, and it's really, really... depressing.
Yeah, I mean, we were the 13 colonies. We get nothing. Anyway, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, what do you got?
No. Well, the Washington Post did a great story about Ivanka. This is also not happy, but interesting. And they were saying, having Ivanka in the role that she's in is the downfall of democracy. And she was in Berlin recently for some reason on a panel among the Chancellor of Germany, the Canadian Foreign Minister, and she was there as first daughter. And this was the great part. Another member of the panel in Germany asked at one point, the German audience is not that familiar with the concept. Who are you representing, your father as president of the United States, the American people, or your business? And they actually asked her that. Of course, no answer. And it just, you know, points to the distinction now. They pointed out that the thing that distinguishes rule of law democracies from dictatorships is their reliance on procedure and not individual whim, and on officials, experienced people, subject to public scrutiny and ethic laws, not the unsackable relatives of the leader, and that distinction is now fading.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, one in a series of many outrages.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, I get that it's not uplifting, but still, in a moment when Ivanka had to squirm, you know, I'll take that as a positive,
so,
being confronted by others about what she's doing down mm-hmm. in Washington. Yeah.
So I want to introduce our next guest, Larisha Hawkins. Dr. Larisha Hawkins serves as the Abed El Kader Visiting Faculty Fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture. She works on the Race, Faith, and Culture Project, which examines how multiracial communities of faith could impact American race relations, and also the Pluralism Project, which studies changing majorities and minorities. She received her BA in History and Sociology from Rice University, an MPA from University of Oklahoma, completed her PhD at the University of Oklahoma in Political Science. Welcome, Dr. Larisha Hawkins.
Guys, today.
Thank you.
Hey, hi.
Thank you. So you're a political science professor. You were the first black woman. I just want to get right to this interesting story. You were the first black woman to receive tenure at the Christian Liberal Arts College, Wheaton, in Chicago. And you went from probably anonymity to being the focus of really divisive controversy there and the subject of a lengthy New York Times story, among other stories, and a sought-out speaker and activist. So could you give us the timeline and the story of what happened and how it started?
Sure. On December 10th, 2015, I posted on Facebook about my intention to wear a hijab or a headscarf in solidarity with Muslim women. In the previous month, San Bernardino had occurred, and just down the road in Richmond, Virginia, Jerry Falwell Jr., the president of Liberty University, said in chapel, which for those who didn't grow up in the buckle of the Bible Belt like I did, chapel is church. And he said, in reference to San Bernardino, you know, if they show up here, they being Muslims, let's end those Muslims before they end us. And by the way, what I'm packing in my back pocket, is it legal to bring that out here? Meaning a gun. And he said he encouraged then students at Liberty University to sign up for gun permit classes on campus. So this kind of incitement to violence coming from the perch of the pulpit, essentially, of one of the Abrahamic, three major Abrahamic religions, sickened me. It disgusted me. And in conversation with some students about things they were mulling through in terms of their own activism, wearing the hijab was one of the ones that some students thought as a one kind of stop effort on the airplane home. So we started commiserating with the Council on American Islamic Relations in Chicago about whether that would be viewed as mostly, you know, haram or unclean in the eyes of my friends in the Islamic faith. And so what they said was, no, we would view that as an act of solidarity, not of cultural appropriation, as people have called it. So that kind of began me wearing the hijab. Of course, it was finals week. Students didn't follow through so much on wearing it during school. And then the Chicago Tribune covered it when I was wearing it at church. And then after that, within a day, the Facebook post went viral. And so that kind of just, you know, ballooned from there. And it obviously came to the attention of my employers, Wheaton College.
And then what happened after that? I mean, keep going with
that. Well, following that, just a series of events that led eventually to my separation from the university. Mm-hmm. And so 2 months, so beginning December 15th and then ending around February 6th when there was a separation agreement, settlement kind of with the university, and then my life has kind of unfolded from there. So, mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, I think there's probably some things you can't talk about, but, you know, How do you feel as a black woman? This happened to you as a black woman.
Yeah.
I mean, I keep thinking, what if it were somebody else who was not black?
Right. My mom always liked to say, could you imagine if, I think in the very beginning, my mom, obviously my family was in shock about everything that was happening. And I had just not only having tenure, I had been at Wheaton College for 8.5 years. So 8.5 meaning that semester was my last semester, fall of 2015. She said, what if someone like Angelina Jolie had done this? Like, the response right. would have been very different, right? And so not just that wearing of the hijab, which people have called kind of, I call it embodied solidarity. People have called it performance art and other kinds of things. What I think is really telling is that there's a dynamic within a kind of broader evangelicalism, a kind of political, religious culture, religio-political culture that's rampant in the United States. And that's the 81%, was it 81%, 82% who solidified Trump's victory. So I think this is highly related to the politics of religion in the United States writ large. I think it's not inseparable from that broader dynamic that I saw the undercurrent of. And I just think I saw that it was forceful and strong maybe earlier than other people did. Well, I think I did. I'm a political scientist. That's what I'm attuned to, the racial, ethnic, religious dynamics of Trump's very early rhetoric.
Yes, and you're listening to 94.7 WPVC. This is Apropos of Something. And we're going to go to a break, and then we're going to come back and continue this, really, the beginning of this great discussion with Dr. Larisha Hawkins. We'll be right back after this message. We're back. This is Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with Dr. Hawkins, the Abed El Kader Visiting Faculty Fellow at the University of Virginia at the Advanced Studies in Culture Institute. And what we didn't say before the break, which was the end of the story, or part of, not the end of the story, but what happened in at Wheaton College was that as a result of the hijab and publishing a paper, maybe we'll get into that she was requested to, or not publishing, but writing a paper, they basically pushed Dr. Hawkins out of the college. So can you speak a little bit about what happened surrounding that and wherever you want to take that?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that, I'll just talk a little bit about my, you know, we started talking before the break about what it is to be, you know, not just a black body in a particular kind of religio-political space. It's also an issue of being a female body. And so it's very storied, the role, not the role, but the kind of burden that women and people of color bear in academia. And so even like beyond just the regular, microaggressions and microassaults that you know, marginalized folk feel, there's an added kind of burden in this religious space of coming from a tradition, the black church, where the prophetic voice is very prominent and speaking truth to power, I think is what your show is about, right? It's like, in whatever situation we're in, what does it look like to be those? And like the prophetic voice, prophet just means to tell the truth. And so when we think of great prophets in history that we all revere, like why is it that whether people like actively have faith in Jesus, they think of Jesus as this radical figure? It's because he spoke truth to the religious and political and social and cultural elites of his day and stood on the side of women and other folks who are marginalized. And so I think that in a white evangelical space, and I always like to say when I was at Wheaton, like Wheaton College is not just an evangelical space. I grew up in Oklahoma, which is the buckle of the Bible Belt. I understand evangelicalism. I understand white evangelicalism. Wheaton College is a kind of evangelicalism on steroids, because I think the institution sees its role, takes its role very seriously. It's often called the Harvard of Christian colleges. So of upholding a kind of Christian orthodoxy, if you will, but not just Christian orthodoxy, evangelical orthodoxy. And so a black body in that space, I would explain to people at some point, I said, every day I walk on this campus is culture shock, right? Because my body is automatically suspect in ways that other folks' bodies are not, even though my Christian credentials are very, you know, astute and clear. My academic credentials are the same. And again, we're talking about one of the top liberal arts colleges in the country, regardless of its religious, you know, flavor. I'm talking like students who graduate, and I'm writing letters for students to go to Yale and Harvard and Penn and Pepperdine and other UVA. In fact, I had a student who won one of the top UVA law school scholarships, full ride to UVA law school. And so we're talking about folks like that, students of this ilk and quality, and professors of that same kind of caliber. So I also like to kind of correct the misnomer that this is just like Bob Jones, or, you know, that we're talking about folks who are geared toward higher education in ways that, you know, UVA would be proud of. So I think those kinds of tensions were always inherent there. And I think then they kind of blew up in this situation in a way that everything was on the table. And I think what can't be mistaken is because it was a Facebook post, I took a selfie, and I always like to joke, like, if I had people say, Larisha, didn't you know your institution was going to get mad that you made this statement on Facebook? Part of the statement was, I stand with my Muslim sisters and brothers, not because they're Americans, but because they're humans. I stand in human solidarity with them first. And then I said, secondly, I stand in religious solidarity because we are people of the book. And as Pope Francis said last week, we worship the same God. So I was referencing, you know, Pope Francis washing the feet of various Muslims, standing in solidarity with Muslims who are being attacked by Christians in certain Central Eastern African countries. And so those were fighting words for a potential constituency of Wheaton College, I think. And so those were the kinds of things that I think made this, conservative websites kind of lobbed onto it. I think conservative websites, alt-right kinds of publications were the ones that really propelled this. I mean, it got a lot of cachet on Facebook. I noted how within an hour of posting it, how many people had shared it or liked it. And I was like, well, that's interesting. And then I went to bed and taught an entire day. But halfway through the day, I'm getting calls from NBC. And I'm like, I have to go do with, you know, be on a thesis defense, right? Hi, Nancy. Sorry, I keep forgetting you're over there.
No. That's so, okay. I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry.
No. But anyway, yeah. So that's just kind of a little bit of the kind of tenor of what was happening at the time.
That was actually a question which you, unless I interrupted it, I think
no,
you answered,
not at all.
Which was, I was just curious, when you had posted that on Facebook, if you had any expectation or prediction or gave it, you know, a thought that this might set off anything, let alone what it did set off.
No. I mean, at the end of the post, I said, so also to recontextualize for your listeners, December is important because as a Christian, I was also thinking it's Advent, right? So we just, you know, Christians just celebrated Easter. I was just saying for Lent, I gave up tweeting about Donald Trump. So I was kind of thinking at Advent, like, it's Larisha Hawkins' religious privilege as a Christian in the United States to put on a headscarf at the beginning of the day and take it off. Or, because it kind of started with a conversation with a student, I actually said to her, I said, I am willing to embody this, right, to model this during school, you know, so that we can get more students kind of involved in this effort. Because we were actually thinking of college students as a really important place going home after during Christmas break, after Christmas break, after finals. If every woman in, you know, colleges across the country wore a headscarf in the airport, like, who's the real Muslim, right? Will the real Muslim stand up? It was that kind of thing. And so when I said, I am willing to do this with you, and by the way, I should add, I had started a peace and conflict studies program at Wheaton College. This is kind of part of perpetuating what I think of as embodied solidarity, not making peace with oppression. So we're kind of trying to live what we teach, like making our pedagogy our actual practice, like not just being a political scientist who talks about justice. It's easy to talk about justice and tell my students, but the struggle is always for us in this profession, how do we live it and how do we model it and how do we make that an active part of our pedagogy in the classroom and take the classroom outside? And so it was invigorating to think, this student sparked this idea, and I just declared my intention on Facebook, and I said, actually, it's my religious privilege, again, to put it on, take it off, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to wear it full-time throughout the season of Advent as a kind of religious fast, if you will, right? And so I just said, this is my Christmas wish, that all of you in Facebook land would also wear a headscarf in solidarity with Muslim women in embodied solidarity. So that's it.
So when you did that, there was this outrage, or, you know, and then you were in discussions, and then they basically said, you have another chance, in their words, you have another chance, will you write a paper explaining your position? So can you talk about that a little bit?
Not a lot, but okay. It was just a theological statement.
Okay.
Explaining kind of what I meant about, clarifying things about Muslims, Christians, Jews, etc.
Okay.
And that was the content of the theological statement.
And then, as I understand it, they kept upping the ante, and that really wasn't enough for them, and they really forced you to, you know, decide what you were going to do as a human being. And that's what caused you to be pushed out. Okay. So
I was actually wondering, the when you did separate from Wheaton, with you got all this press, and what in your, you know, in terms of invitation, sorry, what kind of attention did you get? Where did you wind up speaking, and who was seeking you out as a result?
Sure. Well, during the, you know, the interim between December 15th and February 6th or 7th or so, I was featured in the New York Times, The Guardian, so international papers, local papers in Chicago area, daily national newspapers in the United States. So all of the major publications, Time Magazine, Newsweek, etc. I remember going to church, and this woman said she and her son were at the dentist, and the kid was like sitting in the lobby, and he picked up a magazine. He goes, "Mom, that's the woman from church." And it's a very small church, but we don't know. I don't know everyone in the church. I had actually just started attending this great Episcopalian, small, affirming Episcopalian church in the west side of Chicago. And so it was just this tiny little community of folks who really lived out and embodied solidarity, right? This radical vision of inclusion in the body of Christ. So anyway, it was so widespread that, like, I would have people on the street, people in my lawyer's building, like the doorman would say, "Aren't you that woman?" You know, so it was kind of crazy. Since then, I've spoken at various places, spoke at Harvard Div School about a month ago. I've been recently at Pomona College. So just a number of various venues and places throughout the United States. And next week, I'll be in Berlin speaking at an academic freedom conference at the Free University of Berlin, kind of talking about the iron cage of the ivory tower. And I just think part of my fight, I was talking to Ellen about this, is also for labor solidarity, because the idea that in our workplaces, whether it's academia or elsewhere, that there's a sense that there are established procedures and things of this nature. And, you know, I was faithful to the spirit of what Wheaton College was about. I won teaching awards there. My students love me. Again, I was trusted to start an entirely new program in peace and conflict studies. So the irony of starting a peace and conflict studies program and then, you know, becoming the center of such controversy for doing something that, in my mind, epitomizes what Jesus says his followers are to do, which is to love our neighbors in radical ways that require bodily sacrifice and sometimes the ultimate sacrifice. I think we're called to stand between oppressor and oppressed as humans. I mean, you know, referencing what Warren said, like, why do I care about my neighbor? Because we're created of the, I said this in the post, we're created of the same primordial clay. We're the same. There's very little that separates us and distances us unless we create those kinds of imaginaries and frames that divide us. So,
yeah, thank you. I mean, artists and activists right now feel very important. So thank you for what you've done.
Sure.
Yeah.
And describing it. Yeah, it was wonderful to meet you, Larisha.
Thank you.
Great. Yeah. Would that be the takeaway? You would say if you want people to take away one thing, what would that be?
Mm-hmm. I would say that, I think this is going to sound radical, but you guys have been talking this whole show. I think we need to be, some of us are going to die in this fight. I'm just committed to that. I mean, my grandmother hates it when I say that. She says, "None of us." And I said, "Granny, what makes you think it's not going to be some of us?" I think it's that serious. You know, the picture of bodies piled up with Trump and Paul Ryan on the top. You know, we should see the bodies. We should count the cost. And part of counting the cost is being willing to risk something for those who are the most oppressed in our world, in our backyard. And, you know, everywhere we are, there are ways that we can see oppression and stand between, again, the powers that be and those who lack power and empower them, I think, is important, too. So, you know, we don't make martyrs ourselves, but we have to be willing to be martyred for what's right and what's true and what's just.
Thank you. We've been talking with Dr. Larisha Hawkins. She's at UVA right now. She works on the Race, Faith, and Culture Project, and she can be found on Twitter at Larisha Hawkins. It's LARYCIA or LarishaHawkins.com. I imagine that there's a lot of information there on that website, and go to it.
Yes.
And follow, see where you're talking next.
Yeah.
So thank you so
thank you both
much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, Nancy, how you doing?
So, Ellen, I think I have, 5 seconds, or should we just skip it? You tell me. A palate cleanser.
15.
Because you're my palate cleanser.
Could you go 15 seconds? Try it.
I can. It was simply, believe it or not, when you played Mary Had a Little Lamb on your iPhone, that will forever be, okay, so 10 seconds, 4, 3, 2, 1, your
so
turn.
To
it was amazing. I need to give it more due, but you are not letting me. Your turn.
Just to clarify, we can talk about me.
Qualify. No, I think...
It was on the phone, just like, you know, when we were little kids, we used to play tunes.
I think everyone gets it.
All right. Everyone. I'm ever the explainer. Well, I want to thank everybody for being here. Thanks, listeners. Remember that no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. We wanted to thank Keller Williams, the Beckham team there, for sponsoring our show. Thanks. And next week, we're going to take a break. We'll be back on May 13th. We'll see you.
And speaking of doing something, do follow us on Twitter at AOS
Absolutely.
Radio. How about that?
Absolutely.
All right.
See you later.
You were saying. Okay.
See you later. Bye, Nance.